and such a sky of stars. Ah, mountain stars are not these apologetic pinpricks over Connerb skies. Hanging plump, they drip light. A boulder stirred just a meter away. Ah, miss you, said the abbess, an early riser. I wished her good morning. The younger colonists, the old woman confided, worry about her wandering around before sunup, in case she fell off the edge. She produced a pipe from her sleeve, stuffed its bowl and lit it. A raw local leaf, she admitted, but she had lost the taste for refined Marlboros years ago. The smoke smelled of aromatic leather and dried dung. I asked about the stone figure in the escarpment across the gulf. Siddhartha had other names, she told me, mostly lost now. Her predecessors knew all the stories and sermons, but the old abbess and senior nuns were sentenced to the lighthouse when non-consumer religions were criminalized. The present abbess had been a novice back then, so unanimity judged her young enough for reorientation. She was raised in an orphan's block in Pearl City, Connerb, but she said she had never left her abbey spiritually. She returned years later and founded the present colony in the wreckage. I asked if Siddhartha was indeed a god. Many called him so, the abbess agreed, but Siddhartha does not influence fortune or weather, or perform many of a divinity's traditional functions. Rather, Siddhartha is a dead man and a living ideal. The man taught about overcoming pain and influencing one's future reincarnations. But I pray to the ideal, she indicated the meditating giant, early so he knows I'm serious. I said I hoped that Siddhartha would reincarnate me in her colony. Light from the coming day defined the world more clearly now. The abbess asked why I hoped so. It took a little time to form my answer. I said how all purebloods have a hunger, a dissatisfaction in their eyes, except for the colonists I had met. The abbess nodded. If consumers found fulfillment at any meaningful level, she extemporized, copocracy would be finished. Thus, media is keen to scorn colonies such as hers, comparing them to tapeworms, accusing them of stealing rainwater from WaterCorp, royalties from VegCorp patent holders, oxygen from AirCorp. The abbess feared that, should the day ever come when the board decided they were a viable alternative to corporocratic ideology, the tapeworms will be renamed terrorists, smart bombs will rain, and our tunnels flood with fire. I suggested the colony must prosper invisibly, in obscurity. Exactly. Her voice hushed. A balancing act as demanding as impersonating a pureblood, I imagine. She knew you weren't a pureblood all along? How? It seemed tactless to ask. Maybe a spy hole in our quarters had captured me imbibing soap. My host informed me that experience had taught the colonists to keep a friendly eye on their guests, even union men. The abbess herself disliked such a violation of the old abbey's hospitality codes, but the younger colonists were adamant that close surveillance be maintained. She revealed her intelligence only to bid me luck in my future enterprises. For all of corpocracy's crimes against the downstrata, the abbess stated, nothing is more heinous than the enslavement of your tribe. I presume she meant fabricants, but was she speaking in specific terms, servers and dineries, or general terms, every fabricant in Neosokopros? I did not know, and did not learn that until the following night in Pusan. But by now breakfast pans were banging in the courtyard. The abbess looked at the cleft to the courtyard and changed her tone. And who might this young coyote be? The mute boy padded over and sat by the abbess's feet. Sunlight bent around the world, lending fragile color to wildflowers. So day two as a fugitive got underway. Yes, Heiju breakfasted on potato cakes and fig honey. Unlike the previous night, no one pressed me to eat the pureblood food. As we said our farewells, two or three of the teenage girls, tearful to see Heiju depart, shot me hateful glances, much to my guide's amusement. Heiju had to behave like a hard-bitten revolutionary, but he was still a boy in some respects. As she embraced me, the abbess whispered in my ear, "I shall ask Siddhartha to grant your wish." Under his gaze, we left that rarefied height and hiked down through the noisy forest, where we found our ford untouched. Progress toward Yongju was fair. We passed upbound timber rigs driven by burly same-stem fabricants, but the rice plain north of Andongo Lake is laced with exposed timber tracks, so we stayed inside the ford most of the day, hidden from eyesats until hour 15 or so. Crossing an old suspension bridge above Chuang San River, we got out to stretch our legs. Heiju apologized for his pure-blood bladder and pissed into the trees 200 meters below. Over the other side, I studied the monochrome parrots who roost there, on guano-stained chasm ledges. Their flapping and honking reminded me of Boom Suk Kim and his exec friends. A ravine wound upstream. Downstream, the Chuang San River was channeled through leveled hills before disappearing under Ulsong's canopy for sewage duty. Arrows clustered over the Connor, black and silver dots. The bridge cables groaned under the strain of a gleaming exec ford without warning. It was an expensive auto to encounter on such a rustic road, suspiciously so. Heiju reached into our ford for his Colt. He returned to me, hand in his jacket pocket, murmuring, "Let me do any talking, and get ready to dive down." Sure enough, the exec ford slowed to a stop. A stocky man with a face-scaped sheen swiveled out from the driver's seat with a friendly nod. "Beautiful afternoon." Heiju nodded back, observing it was not too sultry. A pure-blood woman unfolded her legs from the passenger door. Her thick wraparounds revealed only a pixie nose and sensual lips. She leaned on the opposite railing with her back to us and lit a Marlboro. The driver opened the Ford trunk and lifted out an airbox, one suitable for transporting a medium-sized dog. He unlocked its clickers and lifted out a striking, perfectly formed but tiny female form, about 30 centimeters in height. She mewled, terrified, and tried to wriggle free. When she caught sight of us, her miniature, wordless scream became imploring. Before we could do or say anything, the man swung her off the bridge by her hair and watched her fall. He made a plopping noise with his tongue when she hit the rocks below and chuckled.
"Cheap riddance," he grinned at us, "to very expensive trash."
I forced myself to remain silent. Sensing the effort this cost, Heiju touched my arm. One scene from the Cavendish Disney, when a pureblood gets thrown off a balcony by a criminal, replayed itself in my head.
"I presume he had discarded a fabricant living doll."
Yes, the exec was keen to tell us all about it.
"The Zizi Hikaru doll was the must-have the sextet before last. My daughter didn't give me a moment's rest. Of course, my official wife," he nodded at the woman on the other side of the bridge, "put her all in, morning, noon, and night. How am I supposed to look our neighbors in their faces if our daughter is the only girl on our carousel to not have a Zizi? You got to admire the marketers of these things. One junky toy fabricant, but genome it like some glitzy antique idol, and up goes its price by 50,000. That's before you shell out for designer wear, dollhouse, accessories. So what did I do? I paid for the damn thing, just to shut the women up. 4 months later, what happens? Teen Cool surfs on, and Marilyn Monroe dethrones poor passé Zizi."
He told us, disgustedly, that a registered fabricant expire cost $3,000, but the man jerked a thumb over the railing. An accidental plunge comes free. So why chuck good dollars after bad?
"Pity," he winked at Heiju. "Divorces aren't as hitchless, eh?"
"I heard that, fat ass." His wife still did not deign to face us. "You should have taken the doll back to the franchise and had your soul redollared. Our Zizi was defective. It couldn't even sing. The damn thing bit me."
Fat ass replied sweetly,
"Can't imagine why that didn't kill it, darlingest."
His wife muttered a casual obscenity, while her husband ran his eyes over my body and asked Heiju if we were vacationing near that remote spot or passing through on business.
"Okyampyo, sir, at your service."
Heiju gave a slight bow and introduced himself as a fifth stratum aide in Eagle Accountancy Franchise, a minor corp division. The exec's curiosity died.
That's so. I manage the Gulf Coast between Pyonghae and Yongdok. You are a golfer, Pyo?
No.
No! Golf isn't just a game, you know. Golf is a career advantage.
The Paegam course, he promised, has an all-weather 54-holer, lickable greens, lake features like the beloved chairman's famous water gardens.
We outbid the local downstrata for the aquifer. Normally you can't get a membership for love nor money unless you're a seer. But I like you, Pyo, so just mention my name to our membership people. Seer Kwan.
Okyeom Pyo gushed gratitude. Pleased, Seer Kwan began telling his exact life story, but his wife tossed her Marlboro after the Zizi Hikaru, climbed into the Ford, and kept her hand on the horn for 10 seconds. Zebra-feathered parrots cannonaded skyward. The exec gave Heiju a rueful grin and advised him to pay the extra dollars to conceive a son when he gets married. As he drove off, I wished for his Ford to plunge off the bridge.
You considered him a murderer?
Of course. One so shallow, moreover, he did not even know it.
But hate men like Seer Kwan, and you hate the whole world.
Not the whole world, archivist. Only the corporocratic pyramid that permits fabricants to be killed so wantonly, casually.
When did you finally reach Pusan?
Nightfall. Heiju pointed at Exxon clouds from Pusan Refinery, turning melon pink to anthracite gray, and told me we had arrived. We entered Pusan's northern rim on an uneyed farm track. Heiju deposited the Ford at a lockup in Samyon suburb, and we took the metro to Choryang Square. It was smaller than Changmyo Plaza, but is busy, and strange after the silent emptiness of the mountains. Fabricant nannies scooted after their exec charges. Swanning couples assessed couples swanning. Corp-sponsored 3Ds competed to outdazzle all the others. In a tatty back galleria, an old-style festival was taking place, where hawkers sold palm-sized curios. Friends for life. Toothless crocs, monkey chiclets, jonah whales and jars. Heiju told me these pets are an old cheapjack's ruse. They die 48 hours after you get them home, invariably. A circus man was touting for business through a megaphone.
Marvel at the two-headed schizoid man! Gaze upon Madame Matryoshka and her pregnant embryo! Gasp in horror at the real live American, but don't poke your fingers into his cage!
Pure-blood sailors from all over Neosocopras sat in frontless bars, flirting with topless comforters under the scrutiny of Pimp Corp men. Leathery Himalayans, Han Chinese, pale-hued hairy Baikalese, bearded Uzbeks, wiry Aleutians, coppery Viets and Thais. Comfort houses Advies promised satisfaction for every peccadillo a hungry pureblood could imagine.
If soul is a boardman's faithful spouse, said Heiju, Pusan is his no-pantied mistress.
Backstreets grew narrower. A funneled wind bowled bottles and cans along, and hooded figures hurried by. Heiju led me through a surreptitious doorway, up a glimlit tunnel to a portcullised entrance. Kukji Mansions was inscribed over a side window. Heiju pressed a buzzer. Dogs barked, the blind unzipped, and a pair of identical saber-tooths slavered at the glass. An unshaven woman hauled them aside and peered at us, her gem-warted face lit with recognition at Heiju, and exclaimed,
Nun Hel Han, it's been nearly 12 months. Little wonder if the rumors about your brawls were even half true. How were the Philippines?
Heiju's voice had changed again. I checked involuntarily, so hard-scoured was his accent now. It was still him at my side.
Sinking, Mrs. Lim, sinking fast. You haven't gone subletting my room now, have you? Oh, I keep a reliable house, don't worry about that. She faked offense, but warned she would need a fresh blip of dollars if his next voyage lasted as long as his last.
The portcullis rose, and she glanced at me.
Say, Nunhell, if your fluffball stays over a week, single apartments get charged as doubles. House rules, like it or lump it, all the same to me. Nunhelhan, the sailor, said I would stay for only a night or two. In every port, the landlady leered. It's true, then.
Was she union?
No. Flophouse landladies judice their own mothers for a dollar. Judicing a union man would fetch a far higher price. But as Heiju told me, they also discourage the idly inquisitive. Inside, a parked stairwell echoed with arguments and 3Ds. I was, at last, getting used to stairs. On the 9th floor, a woodworm corridor led us to a scraped door. Heiju retrieved a pre-placed match stump from its hinge, noting the management had succumbed to a nasty rash of honesty. Nunhel's flop room had a sour mattress, a tidy kitchenette, a closet of clothes for varying climates, a blurred photo of naked Caucasian prostitutes straddling a group of sailors, souvenirs from the 12 conurbs and minor ports, and, of course, a framed Kodak of the beloved chairman. A lipsticked Marlboro was left teetered on a beer can. The window was shuttered. Heiju showered and changed. He told me he had to attend a union cell meeting and warned me to keep the window shutter down and not to answer the door or phone unless it was him or a piece with this crypto. He wrote the words, "These are the tears of things," on a scrap of paper, which he then burned in the ashtray. He put a small supply of soap in the fridge and promised to return in the morning, soon after curfew.
Surely such a distinguished defector as yourself deserved a rather grander reception.
Grand receptions draw attention. I passed some hours studying Poussin's geography on the Sony before showering and imbibing my soap. I woke late, I think, after hour 6. Heiju returned exhausted, holding a bag of pungent tteokbokji. I made him a cup of Starbuck, which he drank gratefully, then ate his breakfast.
"Okay, Sonmi. Stand by the window and cover your eyes."
I obeyed. The rusty shutter uprolled. Heiju commanded,
"Don't look! Don't look! Now, open your eyes."
A swarm of roofs, throughways, commuter hives, advies, concrete. And there, in the background, the bright spring sky sediment had sunk to a dark band of blue. Ah, it mesmerized me, like the snow had done. All the woe of the words, "I am," seemed dissolved there, painlessly, peacefully. Heiju announced, "The ocean."
"You'd never seen it before."
"Only on Papa Song's 3Ds of life and exaltation, never the real thing with my own eyes. I yearned to go and touch it and walk by it, but Heiju thought it safest to stay hidden during daylight until we were recorded somewhere more remote. Then he lay on the mattress and within a minute began snoring. Hours passed. In ocean slots between buildings, I watched freighters and naval vessels. Downstrata housewives aired worn linen on nearby rooftops. Later the weather grew overcast and armored arrows rumbled through low clouds. I studied. It rained. Heiju, still asleep, rolled over, slurred, "Nor only a friend of a friend," and fell silent again. Drool slid from his mouth, wetting his pillow. I thought about Professor Meffi. In our last seminar, he had spoken of his estrangement from his family and confessed he spent more time educating me than teaching his own daughter. Now he was dead, because of his belief in union. I felt gratitude, guilt, and other emotions, too. Heiju woke mid-afternoon, showered and brewed ginseng tea. How I envy purebloods, your rainbow cuisine archivist. Before my ascension, soap seemed the most delicious substance imaginable, but now it tastes bland and gray. I suffer nausea if I so much as taste pureblood food, however, and vomiting later. Heiju downshuttered the window.
"Time to liaise," he told me.
Then he unhooked the beloved chairman's Kodak and placed it face down on the low table. Heiju unplugged his Sony to a socket concealed in the blemished frame.
"An illegal transceiver, hidden in a Kodak of Nia's architect."
"The sacred is a fine hiding place for the profane." A 3D of an old man clarified brightly. He looked like an inexpensively healed burn victim, his lips out of sync with his words,
He congratulated me on my safe arrival in Pusan and asked who had the prettier face, him or the carp. I replied honestly, the carp. Angkor Api's laugh became a cough.
This is my true face, whatever that means these days.
His sickly appearance suited him well, he said, because casual enforcers worried that he might be contagious. He asked if I had enjoyed my journey across our beloved motherland. Heiju Im had looked after me well, I answered. General Apis asked if I understood the role Union wished me to assume in their struggle, to ascend fabricants into citizens. Yes, I began, but I did not have the chance to declare my indecision.
We want to expose you to a formative experience here in Pusan before you decide, Somni.
He warned it would not be pleasant, but imperative.
To allow for an informed decision regarding your future. If you agree, Heiju can take you now.
I said I would go, certainly.
Then we'll speak again very soon, promised Apis, disconnecting his imager.
Heiju produced a pair of Technic uniforms and semi-visors from his closet. We dressed in these, then overcloaked for the landlady's benefit. Outside was cold, and I was grateful for the double layers. We rode the metro to the port terminal and took a conveyor down to the waterfront berths, passing the vast ocean-going vessels. The night sea was oily black, and the ship similarly austere, but one bright vessel pulsed golden arches and resembled an undersea palace. I had seen it before in a previous life. Papa Song's Golden Ark, I exclaimed, telling Heiju what he already knew, that it conveyed the 12-starred east across the ocean to exaltation. Heiju confirmed Papa's Golden Ark was our destination. Security on the gangway was minimal. A bleary-eyed pureblood with his feet on the desk, watching fabricant gladiators slay each other in the Shanghai Coliseum on 3D.
And you are?
Heiju blinked his soul on his eye.
Fifth Stratum Technic Man, Shik Gang.
He checked his hand Sony and reported we had been sent to recalibrate busted thermostats on deck 7.
7? The guard smirked. Hope you haven't just eaten.
Then he looked at me. I looked at the floor.
Who's this verbal marathonette, Technic Gang?
My new aide. Technic Aide U.
That's so. Is tonight your maiden visit to our pleasure dome?
I nodded yes, it was. The guard said there was no time like the first time. He waved us by with a lazy twitch of his foot.
Gaining access to a corpse ship was so simple.
Papa Song's Golden Ark is not exactly a magnet for illegal boarders, archivist. Crew, aides, and various technics bustled in the main gangways, too intent on their own business to notice us. The service side shafts were empty, so we descended to the Ark's underbelly unmet. Our Nikes clanged on the metal stairs. A giant motor drummed. I thought I heard singing, but told myself my ears must be mistaken. Heiju consulted his deck plan, unlatched an access hatch, and I remember him pausing, as if to tell me something. But he changed his mind, clambered in, helped me through, then locked the hatch behind us. I found myself on all fours on a cramped hangway, suspended from the roof of a sizable holding chamber. The hangway's far end was concealed by flaps, but through its gridded floor I could see some 212-starred Papa Song servers, lining up in a paddock of turnstiles whose single direction was onward. Yunas, Hua Suns, Malu Das, Somnis, and some stem types unused in Changmyo Plaza Dinery, all in the familiar gold and scarlet uniform. How dreamlike to see my ex-sisters outside the context of a Papa Song dome. They sang Papa Song psalm over and over. Background hydraulics underbased that sickening melody. But how jubilant they sounded. Their investment was paid off. The voyage to Hawaii was underway, and their new life on Exaltation would shortly begin.
You sound as if you still envy them.
Watching them from the hangway, I envied their certainty about the future. After about a minute, an aide at the head of the line ushered the next server through golden arches, and the sisters clapped. The lucky 12-starred waved back at her friends, then passed through the arch to be shown to her luxury cabin we had all seen on 3D. The turnstiles rotated the fabricants one space forward. After watching this process several times, Heiju tapped my foot and signaled for me to crawl along the hangway, through the flap, into the next chamber.
"Weren't you in danger of being seen?"
"No. Bright drop lights underswung our hangway, so from the noisy holding pen floor, several meters below, we were invisible. Anyway, we were not intruders, but technics, conducting maintenance work." The next chamber was in fact a small room, no bigger than this prison cube. The singing and din was stamped out. Its quiet was eerie. A plastic chair stood on a dais. Above this chair, suspended from a ceiling monorail, hung a bulky helmet mechanism. Three smiling aides dressed in Papasong scarlet guided the server onto the chair. One aide explained that the helmet would remove her collar, as promised by Papasong in matins over the years. "Thank you, aide," burbled the excited server. "Oh, thank you." The helmet was fitted over the Somni's head and neck. It was at this moment I noticed the odd number of doors into the cell.
"Odd? In what way?"
There was only one door, the entrance from the holding pen. How had all the previous servers left? A sharp clack from the helmet refocused my attention on the dais below. The server's head slumped unnaturally. I could see her eyeballs roll back, and the cabled spine connecting the helmet mechanism to the monorail stiffen. To my horror, the helmet rose. The server sat upright, then was lifted off her feet into the air. Her corpse seemed to dance a little. Her smile of anticipation frozen in death tautened as her facial skin took some of the load. Below, meanwhile, one worker hoovered blood loss from the plastic chair, and another wiped it clean. The monorailed helmet conveyored its cargo, parallel to our hangway, through a flap and disappeared into the next chamber. A new helmet lowered itself over the plastic stool, where the three aides were already seating the next excited server. Heiju whispered in my ear, "Those ones you can't save, Sanmi. They were doomed when they boarded." In fact, I thought, they were doomed from their womb tanks. Another helmet clacked its bolt home. This server was a Yuna. "You understand, I have no words for my emotions at that time." Finally, I managed to obey Heiju and crawl along the hangway through a sound lock into the next chamber. Here, the helmets conveyed the cadavers into a vast, violet-lit vault. The space must have accounted for a quarter of Papa Song's arc's volume. As we entered, the Celsius fell sharply, and a roar of machines burst our ears. A slaughterhouse production line lay below us, manned by figures wielding scissors, sword saws, and various tools of cutting, stripping, and grinding. The workers were blood-soaked from head to toe. I should properly call those workers butchers. They snipped off collars, stripped clothes, shaved follicles, peeled skin, off-cut hands and legs, sliced off meat, spooned organs. Drains hoovered the blood. The noise, you can imagine, archivist, was deafening. "But what would the purpose be of such carnage?" "The economics of corpocracy. The genomics industry demands huge quantities of liquefied biomatter for womb tanks, but most of all for soap. What cheaper way to supply this protein than by recycling fabricants who have reached the end of their working lives? Additionally, leftover reclaimed proteins are used to produce Papasong food products, eaten by consumers in the corpse dineries all over Neosokopros. It is a perfect food cycle."
"What you describe is beyond the conceivable, Sanmi 451. Murdering fabricants to supply dineries with food and soap. No, the charge is preposterous. No, it's unconscionable. No, it's blasphemy. As an archivist, I can't deny that you saw what you believe you saw. But as a consumer of the corpocracy, I am impelled to say what you saw must, must have been a union set created for your benefit. No such slaughter ship could possibly be permitted to exist. The beloved chairman would never permit it. The douche would ionize Papa Song's entire exec strata in the lighthouse. If fabricants weren't paid for their labor in retirement communities, the whole pyramid would be the foulest perfidy.
Business is business.
You've described not business, but industrialized evil.
You underestimate humanity's ability to bring such evil into being. Consider, you have seen the 3Ds, but have you visited a fabricant retirement village personally? I shall take your silence as a no. Do you know anyone who has visited one personally? Again, no. Then where do fabricants go after retirement? Not just servers. The hundreds of thousands of fabricants who end their serviceable lives every year. There should be cities full of them by now. But where are these cities?
No crime of such magnitude could take root in Nia Socopros. Even fabricants have carefully defined rights guaranteed by the chairman.
Rights are susceptible to subversion, as even granite is susceptible to erosion. My fifth declaration posits, however, in a cycle as old as tribalism, ignorance of the other engenders fear. Fear engenders hatred. Hatred engenders violence. Violence engenders further violence, until the only rights, the only law, are whatever is willed by the most powerful. In corpocracy, this means the douche. What is willed by the douche is the tidy extermination of a fabricant underclass.
But what about the 3Ds of exaltation and such? You saw them in the Papa Songs at Changmyo Plaza yourself. There's your proof.
Exaltation is a Sony-generated simulacrum, digied in Neo-Edo. It does not exist in the real Hawaii or anywhere. Indeed, during my final weeks at Papa Song's, it seemed that scenes of exaltation repeated themselves. The same Hua Soon ran down the same sandy path to the same rock pool. My unascended sisters did not notice, and I doubted myself at the time. But now I had my explanation.
Your testimony must stand as you speak it, despite my protests. We must progress. How long did you watch this slaughter?
I cannot recall accurately. Perhaps 10 minutes, perhaps an hour. I remember Heiju leading me through the dining area, numbly. Purebloods played cards, ate noodles, smoked, worked at Sony's, joked, engaged in ordinary life. How could they know what happened in the underbelly and just sit there, indifferent, as if it were not living fabricants being processed but pickled sardines? Why did their consciences not scream for this obscenity to end? The bearded security guard winked, saying, "Come back soon, honeysuckle." In the metro back to the flophouse, as the commuters swayed, I saw cadavers on the monorail. Ascending the stairwell, I saw them hoisted aloft the execution room. In his room, Heiju did not switch on the solar. He just raised the shutter a few centimeters to let the lights of Pusan dilute the darkness, and poured himself a glass of soju. Not a word had passed between us. I alone, of all my sisters, had seen the true exaltation and lived. Our sex was joyless, graceless, and necessarily improvised, but it was an act of the living. Stars of sweat on Heiju's back were his gift to me, and I harvested them on my tongue. After, the young man smoked a Nuri Marlboro in silence and studied my birthmark curiously. He fell asleep on my arm, squashing it. I did not wake him. The pain turned to numbness, the numbness to pins and needles. Then I squirmed out from under him. I spread a blanket over Heiju. Purebloods catch rogue colds in all weathers. The city readied itself for curfew. Its smeary glow dimmed as advies and lights switched off. The final server of the final line would be dead by now. The processing line would be cleaned and silent. The slaughtermen, if they were fabricants, would be in their dorm rooms,
if pureblood's at home with their families. The Golden Ark would sail away tomorrow to a new port, where the reclamation would begin afresh. At hour zero, I imbibed my soap and joined Heiju under the blanket warmed by his body.
Weren't you angry with Union for exposing you to the Golden Ark without adequately preparing you?
What words could Apis or Heiju have used? Morning brought a sweaty haze. Heiju showered, then devoured a huge bowl of rice, pickled cabbage, eggs, and seaweed soup. I washed up. My pure-blood lover sat across the table from me. I spoke for the first time since we entered the protein extraction line.
That ship must be destroyed. Every slaughter ship in Neosocopus like it must be sunk.
Heiju said yes.
The shipyards that build them must be demolished. The systems that facilitate them must be dismantled. The laws that permitted the systems must be torn down and reconstructed.
Heiju said yes.
Every consumer, exec, and Jewish boardman in Neosocopros must understand that fabricants are purebloods, be they grown in a womb tank or a womb. If persuasion does not work, ascended fabricants must fight with Union to achieve this end, using whatever force is necessary.
Heiju said yes. Ascended fabricants need a catechism to define their ideals, to harness their anger, to channel their energies. I am the one to compose this declaration of rights. Can Union seedbed such a catechism?
Heiju said, this is what we're waiting for. Many expert witnesses at your trial denied declarations could be the work of a fabricant, ascended or otherwise, and maintained it was ghosted by Union or a pure-blood abolitionist. How lazily experts dismiss what they fail to understand. I, only I, wrote declarations over 3 weeks at Ul-Sukdo-Sio, outside Pusan, in an isolated exec villa overlooking the Nakdong estuary. During its composition, I consulted a judge, a genomicist, a syntaxist, and General Encore Apis, but the ascended catechisms of declarations, their logic and ethics, denounced at my trial as the ugliest wickedness in the annals of deviancy, were the fruits of my mind, archivist, fed by the experiences I have narrated to you this morning. No one else has lived this life. My declarations were germinated when Yuna 939 was executed, nurtured by Boom Suk and Fang, strengthened by the tutelage of Mephi and the Abyss, birthed in Papa Song's slaughter ship. And your capture came shortly after completing your text.
The same afternoon. Once my function was fulfilled, there was no reason for unanimity to let me run free. My arrest was dramatized for media. I handed my declarations on Sony to Heiju. We looked at each other for the last time. Nothing is as eloquent as nothing. I knew we would never meet again, and maybe he knew that I knew. At the edge of the property, a small colony of wild ducks survived the pollution. Rogue genomes give them a resilience lacking in their pure-blood ancestors. I suppose I felt a kinship with them. I fed them bread, watched water walkers dimple the chrome-bright surface, then returned to the house to watch the show from inside. Unanimity did not make me wait long. 6 arrows sharked over the water, one landing on the flower garden. Enforcers jumped out, priming their colts, and belly-snaked toward my window with much hand-signing and fearless bravado. I had left the doors and windows open for them, but my captors contrived a spectacular siege with snipers, megaphones, and an exploding wall.
You are implying that you expected the raid, Sonmi.
Once I had finished my manifesto, the next stage could only be my arrest.
What do you mean? What next stage of what?
Of the theatrical production, set up while I was still a server in Papa Song's.
Wait. What about everything? Are you saying your whole confession is composed of scripted events?
It's key events, yes. Some actors were unwitting, Boom Suk and the Abyss, for example.
But the major players were all provocateurs. Heiju Im and Boardman Mephi certainly were. Did you not detect the hairline cracks in the plot?
Such as?
Wing 027 was as stable and ascendant as I. Was I really so unique? You yourself suggested, would Union truly risk their secret weapon on a dash across Korea? Did Seer Kwan's murder of the Zizi Hikaru fabricant on the suspension bridge not underline pure-blood brutality a little too neatly? Was its timing not a little too pat?
But what about Zi Li, the young pure-blood killed on the night of your flight from Taemo-san? His blood was not tomato ketchup.
Indeed not. That poor idealist was an expendable extra in Unanimity's Disney.
But Union, are you saying even Union was fictioned for your script?
No. Union pre-exists me. But its raison d'etre are not to foment revolution. Firstly, it attracts social malcontents like Si Li and keeps them where Unanimity can watch them. Secondly, it provides Neo-Socopros with the enemy required by any hierarchical state for social cohesion.
I still can't understand why Unanimity would go to the expense and trouble of staging this fake adventure story.
To generate the show trial of the decade. To make every last pureblood in Neo-Socopros mistrustful of every last fabricant. To manufacture downstrata consent for the douche's new Fabricant Expiry Act. To discredit abolitionism. You can see, the whole conspiracy has been a resounding success.
But if you knew about this conspiracy, why did you cooperate with it? Why did you allow Heiju Im to get so close to you?
Why does any martyr cooperate with his Judases?
Tell me.
We see a game beyond the endgame. I refer to my declarations, archivist. Media has flooded Neo-Socopros with my catechisms. Every schoolchild in Corpocracy knows my 12 blasphemies now. My guards tell me there is even talk of a statewide vigilance day against fabricants who show signs of the declarations. My ideas have been reproduced a billionfold.
But to what end? Some future revolution? It can never succeed.
As Seneca warned Nero, no matter how many of us you kill, you will never kill your successor. Now my narrative is over. Switch off your silver orison. In 2 hours, enforcers will escort me into the lighthouse. I claim my last request.
Name it.
Your Sony and access codes.
What do you wish to download?
A certain Disney I once began. One night long ago, in another age.
The Ghastly Ordeal of Timothy Cavendish. Mr. Cavendish, are we awake? A licorice snake on a field of cream wriggles into focus. The number 5. November 5? Why does my old John Thomas hurt so? A prank? My God, I have a tube stuck up my willy. I fight to free myself, but my muscles ignore me. A bottle up there feeds a tube. The tube feeds a needle in my arm. The needle feeds me. A woman's stiff face framed with a pageboy haircut. Tut, tut! Lucky you were here when you fell over, Mr. Cavendish. Very lucky indeed. If we had let you go wandering over heaths, you'd be dead in a ditch by now. Cavendish. A familiar name. Cavendish. Who is this Cavendish? Where am I? I try to ask her, but I can only squeal, like Peter Rabbit tossed off Salisbury Cathedral's spire. Blackness embraces me. Thank God. A number 6. November 6. I've woken here before. A picture of a thatched cottage. Text in Cornish or Druidic. The willy tube is gone. Something stinks. Of what? My calves are raised. And my arse is wiped with a brisk, cold, wet cloth. Excrement. Feces. Cloying. Clogging. Smearing. Poo. Did I sit on a tube of the stuff? Oh, No. How did I come to this? I try to fight the cloth away, but my body only trembles. A sullen automaton looks into my eyes. A discarded lover? I'm afraid she is going to kiss me. She suffers from vitamin deficiencies. She should eat more fruit and veg. Her breath stinks. But at least she controls her motor functions. At least she can use a lavatory. Sleep, 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 come free me. Speak, memory. No, not a word. My neck moves. Hallelujah! Timothy Langland Cavendish can command his neck, and his name has come home. November 7. I recall a yesterday and see a tomorrow. Time, no arrow, no boomerang, but a concertina. Bedsores. How many days have I lain here? Pass. How old is Tim Cavendish? 50? 70? 100? How can you forget your age? Mr. Cavendish. A face rises to the muddy surface. Ursula? The woman peers in. Was Ursula your lady wife, Mr. Cavendish? Don't trust her. No, I'm Mrs. Judd. You've had a stroke, Mr. Cavendish. Do you understand? A teeny-weeny stroke. When did it happen? I tried to say. And it happened, came out. She crooned. That's why everything's so topsy-turvy. But don't worry. Dr. Upwood says we're making super progress. No horrid hospital for us. A stroke. Two-stroker. Stroke me. Margot Roker had a stroke. Margot Roker. Who are all you people? Memory, you old sod. I offer that trio of vignettes for the benefit of lucky readers whose psyches have never been raised to rubble by capillaries rupturing in their brains. Putting Timothy Cavendish together again was a Tolstoyan editing job, even for the man who once condensed the 9-volume Story of Oral Hygiene on the Isle of Wight to a mere 700 pages. Memories refused to fit, or fitted but came unglued. Even months later, how would I know if some major tranche of myself remained lost? My stroke was relatively light, true, but the month that followed was the most mortifying of my life. I spoke like a spastic. My arms were dead. I couldn't wipe my own ass. My mind shambled in fog, yet was aware of my witlessness and ashamed. I couldn't bring myself to ask the doctor or Sister Noakes or Mrs. Judd, "Who are you? Have we met before? Where do I go when I leave here?" I kept asking for Mrs. Latham. Basta! A Cavendish is down but never out. When the ghastly ordeal of Timothy Cavendish is turned into a film, I advise thee, director dearest, whom I picture as an intense turtlenecked Swede named Lars, to render that November as a boxer in training for the big fight montage. True Grit Cavendish takes his injections without a quiver. Curious Cavendish rediscovers language. Feral Cavendish, redomesticated by Dr. Upwood and Nurse Noakes. John Wayne Cavendish on a walker. I graduated to a stick, which I still use. Veronica said it lends me a Lloyd George air. Cavendish a la Carl Sagan, caged in a dandelion clock. As long as Cavendish was anesthetized by amnesia, you could say he was content enough. Then, Lars, strike a chord sinister. The 6 o'clock news on the first day of December, advent calendars were on show, had just begun. I had fed myself mashed banana with evaporated milk, without tipping it down my bib. Nurse Noakes passed by, and my fellow inmates fell silent, like songbirds under the shadow of a hawk. All at once, my memory's chastity belt was unlocked and removed. I rather wish it hadn't been. My friends at Aurora House were senile boors who cheated at Scrabble with stunning ineptitude, and who were nice to me solely because in the kingdom of the dying, the most enfeebled is the common Maginot line against the unconquerable Führer. I had been imprisoned a whole month by my vengeful brother, so plainly no nationwide manhunt was underway. I would have to effect my own escape, but how to outrun that mutant groundsman Withers when a 50-yard dash took a quarter of an hour? How to outwit the Noakes from the Black Lagoon when I couldn't even remember my postcode? Oh, the horror, the horror! My mashed banana clagged my throat. My senses rethroned, I observed the December rituals of man, nature, and beast. The pond iced over in the first week of December, and disgusted ducks skated. Aurora House froze in the mornings and boiled in the evenings. The asexual care worker, whose name was Deirdre, unsurprisingly, strung tinsel from the light fittings and failed to electrocute herself. A plastic tree appeared in a bucket wrapped in crepe paper. Gwendolyn Bendinck's organized paper chain drives, to which the undead flocked, both parties oblivious to the irony of the image. The undead clamored to be the advent calendar's window opener, a privilege bestowed by Bendinck's like the Queen, awarding Maundy money. "Mrs. Birkin has found a cheeky snowman, everyone! Isn't that fabulous?" Being Nurse Noakes's sheepdog was her and Warlock Williams's survival niche. I thought of Primo Levi's Drowned and the Saved. Dr. Upwood was one of those Academy Award-winning asses of arrogance you find in educational administration, law, or medicine. He visited Aurora House twice a week, and if, at age 55 or so, his career was not living up to the destiny his name foretold, it was down to us damnable obstacles in the way of all emissaries of healing, sick people. I dismissed him as a possible ally the moment I clapped eyes on him. Nor were the part-time body wipers, bath scrubbers and gunk cookers about to jeopardize their lofty positions in society by springing one of their charges. No, I was stuck in Aurora House, all right. A clock with no hands. Freedom is the fatuous jingle of our civilization, but only those deprived of it have the barest inkling re what the stuff actually is. A few days before our Savior's birthday, a mini busload of private school brats came to sing carols. The undead sang along with wrong verses and death rattles, and the racket drove me out. It wasn't even funny. I limped around Aurora House in search of my lost vigor, needing the lavy every 30 minutes. The organs of Venus are well known to all, but, brothers, the organ of Saturn is the bladder. Hooded doubts dogged my heels. Why was Denham paying my captors his last precious copex to infantilize me? Had Georgette, incontinent with senility, told my brother about our brief diversion from the highway of fidelity so many years ago? Was this trap a cuckold's revenge? Mother used to say, escape is never further than the nearest book. Well, Mumsy, no, not really. Your beloved large print sagas of rags, riches, and heartbreak were no camouflage against the miseries trained on you by the tennis ball launcher of life, were they? But yes, Mum, there again you have a point. Books don't offer real escape, but they can stop a mind scratching itself raw. God knows, I had bog all else to do at Aurora House except read. The day after my miracle recovery, I picked up Half-Lives, and ye gods, began wondering if Hilary V. Hush might not have written a publishable thriller after all. I had a vision of the first Louisa Ray mystery in stylish black and bronze, selling at Tesco checkouts, then a second mystery, then the third. Queen Gwendolyn Bendinck's exchanged a sharp 2B pencil for a blunt blandishment. Missionaries are so malleable, if you kid them, you're a possible convert. And I set about giving the thing a top-to-bottom edit. One or two things will have to go. The insinuation that Louisa Ray is this Robert Frobisher chap, reincarnated, for example. Far too hippie, druggy, new age. I, too, have a birthmark below my left armpit, but no lover ever compared it to a comet. Georgette nicknamed it Timbo's Turd. But overall, I concluded the young hack versus corporate corruption thriller had potential. The ghost of Sir Felix Finch whines, "But it's been done 100 times before." As if there could be anything not done 100,000 times between Aristophanes and Andrew Void Webber. As if art is the what, not the how. My editing work on Half-Lives hit a natural obstacle when Louisa Ray was driven off a bridge and the ruddy manuscript ran out of pages. I tore my hair and beat my breast. Did part two even exist? Was it stuffed in a shoebox in Hilary V's Manhattan apartment? Still abed in her creative uterus? For the 20th time I searched the secret recesses of my briefcase for the covering letter, but I had left it in my Haymarket office suite. Other literary pickings were lean. Warlock Williams told me Aurora House had once boasted a little library, now mothballed. The Jellyvision's so much more real for ordinary people. That's what it boils down to. I needed a miner's helmet and a ruddy pick to locate this library. It was down a dead end, blocked off by stacked-up Great War memorial plaques headed Lest We Forget. The dust was deep and crisp and even. One shelf of back editions of a magazine called This England, a dozen Zane Grey westerns in large print, a cookbook entitled No Meat for Me, Please. That left All Quiet on the Western Front, in whose page corners a creative schoolboy had long ago drawn frames of a cartoon stickman masturbating with his own nose. Where are they now? And Jaguars of the Skies, a yarn of everyday helicopter pilots by America's foremost military suspense writer. But I happen to know ghostwritten at his command center. I shall name no names for fear of legal reprisals, and frankly, bugger all else. I took the lot. To the starving man, potato peelings are haute cuisine. Ernie Blacksmith and Veronica Costello, come in. Your time is up. Ernie and I had our moments, but were it not for these fellow dissidents, Nurse Noakes would still have me drugged up to my ruddy eyeballs today. One overcast afternoon, while the undead were in rehearsal for the big sleep, the staff were in a meeting, and the only sound troubling Aurora House's slumbers was a WWF contest between Fat One Fauntleroy and the dispatcher, I noticed, unusually, a careless hand had left the front door ajar. I crept out on a reconnaissance mission, armed with a fib about dizziness and fresh air. Cold singed my lips and I shivered. My convalescence had stripped me of subcutaneous fat. My frame had shrunk from quasi-Falstaffian to John of Gaunt. It was my first venture outside since the day of my stroke, 6 or 7 weeks before. I circumnavigated the inner grounds and found the ruins of an old building, then fought through unkempt shrubberies to the brick perimeter wall to check for holes or breaches. An SAS sapper could have clambered over with a nylon rope, but not a stroke victim with a stick. Drifts of brown paper leaves were eroded and formed by the wind as I passed. I came to the magnificent iron gates, opened and closed by a flash pneumatic stroke electronic gizmo. Ruddy hell, they even had a surveillance camera and a two-way phone thingy. I imagined Nurse Noakes boasting to the children, I nearly wrote parents of prospective residents, that they slept safe and secure thanks to these state-of-the-art surveillance arrangements, meaning, of course, pay us on time and you won't hear a dicky bird. The view did not bode well. Hull lay to the south, a half-day hike away for a robust stripling down side roads lined with telegraph poles. Only lost holidaymakers would ever stumble across the Institute gates. Walking back down the drive, I heard screeching tires and a furious beep from a Jupiter-red Range Rover. I stepped aside. The driver was a bullish fellow clad in one of those silvery anoraks beloved of transpolar fundraisers. The Range Rover screeched to a gravelly stop at the front steps, and the driver swaggered up to reception like a flying ace from Jaguars of the Skies. Coming back to the main entrance, I passed the boiler room. Ernie Blacksmith poked his head out. A dram of fire water, Mr. Cavendish. I didn't need to be asked twice. The boiler room smelt of fertilizer, but was warmed by the boiler's coal furnace. Perched on a sack of coal and making contented baby noises was a long-time resident with the status of institution mascot, Mr. Meeks. Ernie Blacksmith was the kind of quiet man you notice at second